All right. I'd say let's go ahead and start six after. We can go till about 3:20. So welcome to Diversity Within Environmental Groups. Has anything changed? My name is Nick Hill Swaminathan, and I am the executive editor of GRIST, the environmental news website. And I'd like to introduce our panel, Rhonda Anderson, who's the regional organizing manager in the Detroit office for the Sierra Club, Dr. Dorsita Taylor, James E. Crowfoot, Collegiate Professor and Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan, and Yesenia Funes, staff reporter at the Gizmodo blog Earther, and a well-regarded environmental justice reporter. We are tackling the question of diversity within the environmental movement and environmental organizations. And I know the first question that you're thinking is, what right do journalists have to ask that question when journalism has its own diversity problems? So we're going to try to maybe talk about fixing two birds with one stone here. So obviously, in the current climate, environmental organizations are largely known as progressive entities, but their hiring practices seem to belie their reputation. The institution's lack of diversity has consequences for the movement writ large, and as a result, it creates questions that we need to grapple with as journalists when we're reporting about environmental issues. Dr. Taylor is one of the foremost experts in this issue. She's written multiple reports related to lack of diversity in the hiring practices of environmental and conservation organizations, funding entities, and, you know, where that, if you're having problems at that level, it's throughout the movement. So, and you can tell me if these are the best stats to cherry pick from your volumes of work. But one of the things that really stuck out to me was from a 2014 study that you did called The State of Diversity in Environmental Organizations, which found that ethnic minorities on boards or staffs of environmental organizations was less than 16%, and that fewer than 12% found themselves in leadership positions in these organizations. And you authored another report that came out earlier this year that seemed to find that the issue had not changed significantly in that intervening 4 years. So I wanted to start with you, Dr. Taylor. When you started to look into this issue, sort of what prompted you to start this line of research, and what would you say were the most surprising findings?
So in terms of what prompted me, I'm a perpetual troublemaker, and so I always look around. So, you know, when I originally started my life in conservation in Jamaica, and nobody told brown and black people in the Caribbean or Africa or Asia that we can't do environment, or it's for whites only, or we don't know it, or we're not good at it. You know, I started my career as a zoologist and botanist, and that's what every little brown kid that I knew, especially girls, is what we did, and we were damn good at it. However, I moved to the United States, and I realized, why am I the only non-white student in all these science, biology, environmental courses? So dumb me asked the professor, you know, what's up? These will be really cool courses for other students of color. And he goes, blacks are not interested in the environment. And I was so stunned by that whole thought that simply because of race or entire racial groups are not interested, And I thought to myself, idiot, and I marched over to the library, and every single research article I picked up said exactly what he said. And so from an undergraduate, it really was such a cognitive dissonance for me that my whole life, everything about what I did, was environmental, and I was hardwired. Yet here was somebody telling me not. So as I went through graduate school and then through all my research as an environmental professor, this piece has always stayed with me. And I remember graduating from Yale with 2 PhDs and 3 master's degrees, and I was being called on to go work for some of the guys at Yale who were this whole keg thing. It's true. You know what I'm referring to. And, you know, I was supposed to come be their assistant. Yet I was performing better than them in the classroom. I certainly had more degrees with higher honors from the same university as them. So it tells me that something else was going on institutionally around recruiting, hiring, promotion. And so the 2014 article, everyone calls it Green 2.0, that's one piece. But if you go on ResearchGate, and if you look, for instance, at my website, so that's academic kind of stalking website, and it literally tells me every time somebody pops into any of my reports. It will even show pictures, too. But that site has more updated work. And the 2018 piece that came out, it isn't really a replication of the same study. What I did in 2018 was to say, okay, 2014 put out this report that gives us these very dire statistics. Good news, bad news there. The numbers are low, 16% or lower people of color in the organization. That's kind of bad. Good news is it's an upward trend. If we look at 1990, we only had 1.9%. As we're getting to about 2005, we're getting just above the 10% marker. And most of the studies that's come out between, say, 2012 and now are showing us in and around that 12 to 16%. So to keep my students from really being crazier millennials than they are, I always have to say the trend is upwards. Another thing you asked, more interesting piece, was what's happened to women in the same time. Because if we look around 1988 to 1990, all the studies were showing these same organizations had about 30% women. Today, they're about 62% at the entry level. So when people talk about diversity, one of the things I push is they must disaggregate this women and minority thing, because it often becomes white women, and forget the minority piece and forget the women of color piece. And so that's one of the things in my work that I'm really cognizant of and try to disaggregate that intersectionality. So if you look at what's happening with women, and this follows through to even environment programs. Roughly 62% across the country, regardless of the programs you look at, are female now. So it's a field where you can't apply for any grants that focus on gender if you're looking at women, because we're actually predominantly female. Not at the faculty levels, though, and certainly not at the tenured professor level. I'm still rarefied air to be tenured in one of the top programs in the school. Not just tenured, full professor. So at the entry level, we're seeing over 60% females. As we hit the glass ceiling, we see that drop off. So it's women up here, they catapult down to under 30% as you hit CEO, chair of the board, vice president, president. For people of color, numbers start very low. It trends up a little bit, but if you look at hierarchy, it bottoms out. And so my new work that I'm doing now, my students and I, we're looking at, we're in the process of collecting data on about 10,000. So I like to go big, and yeah. I'm not going home. 10,000 organizations, and we're looking at race, gender. We're looking at hierarchy within that, mm-hmm. and how that plays out. And the numbers are coming back really low for people of color, mm-hmm. Lower for women because we now have a bigger sample. But those of you, when I send you my email to say I've got a great study, please answer me back, because the two pieces that are coming out in that, I like to make trouble. It's wage differentials and wage differentials, bonus differentials by race and gender, and it's going to blow your own mind. So don't ignore me when I send out a little email going, are you guys interested in the study that's just coming out? Hopefully that some of those will start hitting. December, I might wait until January because nobody wants to hear it in December. Wait until January after you've all, you know, had your Christmas treats and have it hit for Black History Month, MLK, and we have some, no one has done this kind of study before to look at not just how do we move up the ladder as women and people of color, but the gender differential and racial differential in payments and salary and compensation. So we're looking at that.
All right, so there's a tip for everybody.
Don't ignore it, man.
It's coming. Winter 2019.
It's coming.
So let's move this from the realm of research into the realm of practice a little bit, and bring in Rhonda as a person of color in a national environmental organization. How do the statistics and how do the trends that Dr. Taylor has uncovered play out on the ground and in your work on a daily basis?
Well, they are in real time, just as she's described. And so I can only talk about the Sierra Club because that's where I work. I've worked there for the past 18 years, but 17 years has been as a organizer. As a manager, I just started. Mm-hmm. So that might also give you another hint when you talk about moving up. There could have been maybe some chances of moving up, but I'm not exactly sure. So one of the things that I've come to realize is that the Sierra Club has some difficulties in retaining women of color, in particular black women. So there has been a little bit of research within the club itself as to why that is. All I can say then is that the club is looking very seriously at that and trying to do something about it.
And your sense is the club is earnest in its efforts to address this, mm-hmm. or how do you feel this work is going?
Well, I think that first, and just to give a little bit of background, Sierra Club Environmental Justice Program, mm-hmm. which was as a result, I believe, I'm not exactly sure, of a letter that was sent out to the top 10 environmental organizations. These are the top 10 largest environmental organizations, accusing them of racism. And the response from the Sierra Club was, yes, we are, and that they would try and do something about it. Mm-hmm. The Environmental Justice Program, I believe, has been in the works since 1993. I came on in 2000. And that work of environmental justice was within the club was kind of put to the side, but the work and the effectiveness of the program was huge across the country. So another thing that was very instrumental in that environmental justice program was that it used the environmental justice principles as a guideline. So Sierra Club extracted from the 17 original environmental justice principles and created about 7.
Okay.
Of those principles, one stated that they would hire a organizer from the impacted community.
Mm-hmm.
So that's me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it had nothing to do with my education, my income or anything, whether I was married or anything like that. it was that that person should come from the impacted community.
Right.
There are a couple of others that were, in my mind, instrumental in the way that the work played out. So one other was that we would not go into a community unless we were invited into that community. That's huge. Mm-hmm. That is really, really big, simply because often environmental organizations or any other organization, especially if it's going to be a white ran group, is just going to come because they feel like they have the right. We can come in and we're going to tell you what you should be working on. That was far from the truth. So when I went into a community, it was only after I had been asked to come into that community. And the first question I asked the people in that community was, what's your interest? What are you more concerned about? It wasn't anything about what Sierra Club felt should be addressed, or at least through the environmental justice program. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things that we did and we continue to do. I believe that the environmental justice program within the Sierra Club has been instrumental in spreading throughout the club and its campaigns, using some of the tried and true measures that were primarily done within the environmental justice program. Mm-hmm. And the fruit of that is what you see, especially in Detroit and in the state of Michigan, I think, right now, when it comes to the environmental justice movement.
And I'm going to bring in Yesenia now. And I want to talk to you a little bit about when you hear the dynamics. I mean, you've reported on Dr. Taylor's work before, and you've reported on communities like the one that Rhonda is a part of and that the Sierra Club, you know, sort of identified and brought her in from. How do you see this lack of diversity in these environmental organizations sort of play out in your reporting? Is it you're reporting on a particular community and then you go to somebody for like the big picture view and they don't really know the dynamics on the ground? What is it that you're seeing?
Yeah, well, first off, things have gotten a lot better than when I first started reporting in this space, you know, some years ago. And I think that there's a lot more accountability from these environmental groups on making sure that they're not, you know, being the voice of these communities. However, it's clear that there's very few people within the organizations themselves who are able to answer to these issues within communities. So very often what I have to do is, you know, reach out to like someone at the Sierra Club and, you know, whether it's like a regional person or a national person. And very often they have to connect me to someone who is outside of the Sierra Club and someone who's in a smaller organization within the community itself, which, I mean, I'm sure there's like more people like you who are like regional directors that are within the Sierra Club, but it's really rare that I actually get to speak to someone who's a part of like these organizations themselves, whether it's NRDC, the Nature Conservancy, Sierra Club. And, you know, I appreciate that they're at least being upfront about that, but it also speaks a lot to the way that they run their organizations. And, you know, these are really big organizations that can only have so many people in so many places. But there's a serious lack of diversity in them. And every time I'm speaking to someone, it's very rare that they're a person of color. There are many more women, mm-hmm. But they're almost always white women. And it's there's a hole there. And, you know, it's not impacting my reporting on, like, a day-to-day basis, but it's something that I notice. And it's probably more concerning for me outside of, like, these NGOs than it is in academia, even. You know, for me, a lot of my reporting involves talking to scientists or talking to professors. And I can spend hours trying to find a woman to speak with me or a person of color to speak with me. Those days that I'm like, I'm actually going to make sure that I can quote someone who's not a 60-year-old white man in my piece. And those days, I can't even get a story out at the time that I want to because it's so hard to find someone and someone who also has the time to speak with you. And that's part of the trouble when you're also doing these, you know, community-based stories because folks have work to do. And they have so much work to do that they don't have time to, you know, fairly don't have time to speak to reporters on these issues and need to do the work to solve the issues that they're seeing. And I think that's kind of the role that these larger organizations that have the capacity to, you know, give us those press releases, give us those quotes, sit down with us, you know, though they have the capacity to give us that time, right? So it'd be you know, it would be really helpful for me to see more people who can actually speak to these issues on not just like a professional level, but on a personal level. Because in my, you know, as a reporter, I like to invigorate my stories with strong narrative and someone who actually has personal stakes in these issues. The stories just are so much stronger and they resonate so much more with the audience when you can feel that compassion and that strife in the storytelling. But it is getting better, which is the good side of it all. And I've only been doing this, you know, for like 5 years now, and I've seen changes even in this time. But there's still a lot more that needs to be done. And I'm glad that people are like at least coming to terms with it. You see different organizations. I think it was the Sierra Club that issued like a story maybe a year or two ago, coming to terms with its racist history and laying out all these racist things that it had done and its, you know, long legacy. And that's important. That's powerful because people don't realize that some of these organizations, you know, helped kick Native people off their lands or ignored people who were dying from pollution to spend more time on the birds and the bees, which matter too. And I think that's an important step that we're not seeing enough of. And when organizations take those steps, that's a story. That's a story for us because that's important to shed light on.
And this might be more of a question for Rhonda, but you know, I wrote a story about one of the Green 2.0 reports last year, and I talked to Aaron Mayer, the former Sierra Club president, the first black president of the Sierra Club, and he told me as he was coming up in that organization over the course of 30 years, he felt like he was a double agent because he came from a background of environmental justice and community level groups and grassroots organizing, and then suddenly he was working, you know, at the sort of big green, you know, he was working this big green angle, and he kind of felt like he couldn't tell his community group friends what he was up to with like the big bad Sierra Club. And I'm just kind of curious, is there any remnant of like, what are the remnants of that sort of having to play both sides of the fence, like that are still there? I mean, you talked about the Sierra Club's what sounded like an earnest effort to move into the justice space more aggressively. Do you feel like it's part of the DNA of the Sierra Club now, or is it still?
No, it's definitely not a part of the DNA yet. But the experience that Aaron described is almost the very same thing that I've gone through.
Mm-hmm.
Someone, a very dear friend, Donnell Wilkins, who once was the executive director of Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice, was the one that recommended me for this position that I'm in now. And so once I got the job, I thought, okay, everything is going to be great, but it wasn't. I think the biggest and the greatest pushback that I've received are from other African Americans and about me having this position within the Sierra Club. So often it was kind of painful and hurt, you know, that I wasn't like embracing, oh, you know, but rather, you know, you work for a big green, you know, you work for a racist organization, as if I didn't know it. And it sometimes insinuated that I'm here and not doing anything about it,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so that is so far beyond the truth, you know. And I was just even saying to Dr. Taylor that I believe the reason why I've lasted as long as I have with the Sierra Club is because I have the city of Detroit as my base. So I can move. I talk the way I want to talk. I'm a single mother and raising my family in some of the areas that have the highest poverty rate in the city of Detroit. That's almost unheard of, you know. So it's because of that comfort of working in a place that I'm so familiar with that has allowed, I believe, that has allowed me to stay that long. Now, once I move out of that area, once I move into the larger areas, even here in the state of Michigan, You know, this is one of the most racist places that you can work in. This is the most one of the most racist places you can live in. So then it becomes a challenge. And even among co-workers who feel that, you know, everything is good, you know, and, you know, I sometimes get the feeling that they don't understand how it is for a black person to move in these white areas. Mm-hmm. I just recently came back from Colorado and for a manager's meeting. And I must say, Boulder, Colorado is not Detroit. So, you know, so.
In exactly what way is that?
Well, listen, they have stores dedicated just to socks. I couldn't understand that. I'm like, a store with just socks. You know, so I looked around for people like me, and they were only scattered every now and then, you know. And with the tension and things that you have going on now, you know, I mean, if I get on a flight, if I get anywhere, I'm kind of looking around, you know. And, I'm just, you know, so that's so that's part of it. Yet, I do believe that there's a number of efforts within the Sierra Club to change, especially in the organizing program. And so there's a movement, if you will, around transformation mm-hmm. within the Sierra Club, addressing all of the things that we're talking about, the disparities that Dr. Taylor's research have demonstrated that is so the truth, you know. So an organization like the Sierra Club taking on that effort, taking on the hard part, dealing with hierarchies and and even the issues of white women and women of color, mm-hmm. okay? I believe that just recently the labor group, Progressive Work, I'm not sure, within the Sierra Club, what is it? Listen, this union is so on it, they were able to address the issue of white women's pay versus women of color pay, and they negotiated an increase,
oh, wow.
even to that of the men, okay? There was a fund that was set aside to address the issues of all of those black women that came in before and then left. That money was set aside so that they can go back and work with those women. Mm-hmm. So that's just some of the things that they're doing. I think it's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
But as long as we have the kind of staff workers, you know, that come from the whole, then I think we have a decent chance of making that change. But it's going to take a lot of effort. We have to do more than talk and write good stuff. You know, it has to be about the action itself.
So speaking about that, from your bird's eye view, Dr. Taylor, what are you seeing generally in terms of progress on this issue? And then secondarily, as part of that, I want to ask you to talk a little bit about the meeting or the conference that you held in April.
Mm-hmm. New Horizons.
Yeah.
So to touch a little bit on your former question, for instance, I build pipelines or pathways also, because it's wanting to talk about diversity, to tell everybody else to diversify. And often they say, oh, we can't find any students of color. And there's my thought bubble, and then there's my real reaction, because nobody wants to know what's in the thought bubble. But the reality of it is I am able to find students of color who their grades are good or better than the white students that are being hired. And so, for instance, this year I funded 73 students of color for internships across the country, 41 undergraduates, 43 undergraduates, 30 graduate students. They were the ones I had at the Environmental Grant Makers Association. And these students are second to none. For 20 slots for my undergraduate program, I'm getting up to 400 apps. for the graduate program, I'm getting, you know, to 100 to 200 apps. So it tells us there's demand. Mm-hmm. And again, when I'm going after the best students in the best programs, it's very easy to get the lesser motivated students. It's the ones that people say, we can't find them because they're the ones we want to hire. I've demonstrated that they're there. They want internships, they want jobs, and they're willing to come in. But one of the things we do is we train those students to get at this dilemma of, are you selling out if you go and work for Environment? Are you able to have a career there? Do you have a support service, support structure mm-hmm. around you? And if you're the only one in that space, I've lived that experience. I know what it's like to walk into the Yale School of Forestry, the oldest school of its kind in the country, in 1983, and they didn't even realize they'd admitted their second black woman ever until when I walk in there and the lady at admissions go, oh! I'm like, Jesus, just give me the orientation packet and let's just move on with this. So to not have students have that experience, because it's those moments of isolation, not knowing that their entire stores dedicated to 300 varieties of socks, and there are 10,000 versions of Patagonia fleeces that you must and should wear if you're an environmentalist in certain muted shades and colors and sizes. I had to go and learn all of that stuff on my own. And so with the students I bring in, we go through some of those seemingly trivial things. But what's trivial to my white colleagues in Ann Arbor that don't have to worry about a barbershop? Mm-hmm. If black students were trying to recruit, they, especially black women, they want to know, what the heck do I do with my hair? And can I get anybody to fix it up in here? And if you can't help with that, they're not going to stay. And so we're what's normal and ordinary for some folks becomes, you know, these small barriers to just build on themselves. The isolation, et cetera. And so we work in the programs I'm running. I work with that with the students. That if I take that off the table, I also pay them really, really well. Because many people, when they say we want to recruit students of color, they're talking about free labor or labor paid at, you know, at wages that you don't even pay your babysitter. And as I say to people, if you want me to find you the best talent in the country, you must pay for it.
Right.
And so we talk about it and we go through all of that. And so we have a new set of millennials that are able to say to their friends and colleagues in the black house and the Hispanic house at college, yeah, I do environment. I love it. I love doing this. This is what I'm doing. And I have other people around me and I'm good at it. And I'm going to go into graduate school, or I'm going to go, as I say to the environmental folks, they're going to have your job in 10 years, so watch out. Because I'm not talking about just bringing people in at the introductory level or to be janitors and to sweep the floor. Those are perfectly fine. I want the C-suite.
Yeah.
And I have students who will take the C-suite. Mm-hmm. And so just so people just to understand what we're doing here. So there is some changes. So, for instance, Audubon, Dion Ferris, who is an old environmental justice activist, is the vice president. So we're seeing high-level hires now. Mm-hmm. So not just Aaron Mayer at president of the board, and we need to be careful that president versus president of the board, Rhea Sue at NRDC president. Go check. We see Dion Ferris, Jorge Consuegra at EDF, vice president also, and I think NRDC's vice president is a person of color. So we're really starting to now see these changes at these very high levels. And so someone like Dion, who will tell you where it is any time of the day or night, and coming out of an environmental justice and a civil rights law background, that's her background, going right in at that very top level of the Audubon. When I heard that hire, I thought, oh my God, did David Yarnell know what he got himself into? And so they're making amazing changes because they understand what's going on. So we're seeing new hires, we're seeing consequential hires, and we're seeing organizations now really being pushed.
Right.
At the Environmental Grant Makers, which I just came back from last night, using the transparency report that I put out in 2014, showing, and that was really surprising to me, how few organizations, A, were collecting diversity data, and B, were willing to share it, less than 4%. So it tells us that a lot of this is talk, but the EGA, for the first time, this is over 400 environmental grant makers. They give away to the tune of $4.5 billion. So they're a really powerful group. They put out a statement for the first time where they're forcing their members, or they're urging their members, to collect transparency data, mm-hmm. diversity data. And they're also asking that the foundations, as a part of their grant requirement, ask for diversity data to be revealed. And that's one of the things I asked for in the Green 2.0 report mm-hmm. and in the transparency report that I put out this year. So big movements, you know. So it's not just about the numbers, I think. Mm-hmm. It's about what are some of the structural changes that are going to have, you know, long-term impact, I think, as we go forward. And I think we're seeing some of that shake out.
Well, first, just as a side note, that in the first row over here is my reporter, Justine. If she ever calls you for a story, can you please speak from the thought bubbles? I think those will probably be the best quotes. But I wanted to talk to you, Yesenia, quickly just about the difficulty. You mentioned it, just like how much time it takes to get down to the sorts of people that you want to tell stories about. And one of the big pressures in journalism when you're not even writing about environmental justice is deadline pressure. Mm. So what's your relationship vis-a-vis you and editors when you're trying to get to the most sort of impactful story while you're trying to navigate through, I don't know, all the whiteness to get to the source that you actually want, who's on the ground, who you feel like is the one who's able to speak most passionately, most forcefully about it? And obviously you're not talking about that story that we worked on together earlier this year, but with your other editors.
So, you know, part of it is like picking and choosing battles, right? Like, which story am I actually going to sit down and decide I'm going to take the time out necessary to find these people? And part of it is like, which stories am I willing to just kind of like let it be that maybe all the people in my stories are old white men, which always feels like, I always feel a little defeated when that happens. But I'm really lucky to have an editor that understands environmental justice. I mean, and I report on environmental justice, which is a very specific field in itself, right? Like conservation reporters, reporters who do other environmental issues that might also be, you know, people of color, because people of color not like to write about all types of things. You know, I like to write about justice, but my other friends might want to write about, you know, elephants or some kind of animal that I don't know. but everyone struggles with finding these sources. But because I write about justice, and because my editor and I have a very clear, she understands the process. Like, we have had very clear conversations on, this is what I need with certain types of stories. If you want me to do the story right, and if you want me to do the story well, then I need the time to get this person on the phone. I need the time to maybe go meet this person. I maybe need like a couple interviews with this person on the phone. I've been trying to work on the story about inmates who fight wildfires for maybe like 5 months now. And my editor's chilling. She's fine. She's like, I want you to find the best source to embed in this piece. And until we find that person, it can be on the back burner, which is a little annoying for me because I'm trying to find this person and I can't. but it's really nice because other editors would have been like, you know what, let's just put the story up as is. It's losing its timeliness. I mean, we're entering fall now and people aren't talking about wildfires anymore, but when it comes out, it's going to be even more powerful and so much better than it would have been if I would have released it 2 or 3 months ago. So I'm really lucky in that regard. But the same can't be said for other reporters. It's about maintaining, you know, clear communication with your editors about what you need, especially if you're doing justice reporting. But also some of it is just taking the time and trying to like really build out sources. Be clear if you're trying to find a certain kind of source. You know, there's times where I reach out to people and I'm saying, I'll tell them, I need to find a person of color who's on the ground, who knows this stuff, a person who is in this community. I need to find someone who can actually tell me what is happening and not just speak from like a, oh, this is happening to them perspective. Because it needs, otherwise that's shit reporting. It's not good. And it's inauthentic and it's disingenuine, and the communities deserve way more than that. And your audience, your readers, they deserve to know the truth in its full, in its fullness. But there are days where I was reporting on the mercury and air toxin standards earlier this week, which is really boring policy stuff, but really important when it comes to the health of people who live near coal power plants who might see more mercury spewing out of these facilities and into their air. And I spent like a whole day trying to find someone who wasn't an old white man, at least a woman. I was I got to a point, I'm like, at least just a woman. She could be a white woman. It's all good. Just, I don't want to have three old white dudes in my piece. And I finally found one woman, but, you know, there's still that level of defeat of, I can find someone who lives in these communities who can give me a little bit more than just this academic, this is going to impact these people. Because that always feels just very disconnected, and it just doesn't please me, and it shouldn't please anyone as a reporter if you're reporting on justice. But there's a big gap in this space, I think, outside of environmental justice, because if you notice, like, all these people of color that we're talking about at these organizations often work in EJ spaces.
Right.
But there's interest outside of environmental justice that people of color have in these issues. And those are the spaces that are really lacking. Whenever I try to do a conservation story, which I do a bit of sometimes because my editor knows I get a little depressed with the EJ stuff. it's difficult for me to find anyone who isn't a white person in this space. And it's just another reminder of how much more work we have to do. Because EJ spaces, I think, tend to have more people of color than, say, you know, the conservation piece of an organization. And that's, you know, and that almost makes the EJ space feel separate from everything else. And they really should be working as one. It really should be one organization working toward one goal of cleaning up the environment and making sure people and animals are all healthy. And it often feels like they're not working together, just from a reporting standpoint of trying to plug into people. And that's, I think, where a lot more attention also needs to be. Like, people of color don't just want to do justice work sometimes. You know, there's interest everywhere else, and there needs to be more attention on where people of color want to work and if they don't want to just do stuff on pollution all day.
Actually, for next year at the New Horizons conference, you did ask me about that. I'll invite you and all the other reporters, because that's precisely the logic of that conference. Actually, for the tracking I do, 70% of students of color do not want to do environmental justice. Mm-hmm. They want to do conservation, soils, water. And so the New Horizons conference, I brought together 300 people last year. About 200 were students. They were all students of color, and they're doing everything. And one of the things I do at that conference is to precisely bring together professionals of color who, again, are doing everything. I just came from a conference where the National Geographic journalist, photojournalist, who was scuba diving way deep to get this amazing shot, was a Mexican-American woman. And so I do a lot of that
there's
sort
so
of
much,
stuff.
There's so much interest in, like, the wildlife is. And, like, right. Oceans, conservation right. aspect. You know,
and if you do know, right, and if you do the justice work and the conservation work, there are a ton of people of color throughout these organizations, actually, that can speak to many of the issues mm-hmm. you're talking about. So as journalists, the task is to really be connected into the right kind of network to find them at a moment's notice. And I know for myself, I get a million asks from journalists. I try to respond to them, but sometimes it's 1:45 a.m. and yes, I'm up, but I'm writing my conservation history book. I do not have the time to talk to you by 7 a.m.
Right.
Because especially if it's a Tuesday or Thursday, professors teach, and so you get these inordinately just ridiculous deadlines
yeah.
that people want to now, and I'm like, hey, if you can't wait till like tomorrow or the next day, you know, good luck. So there's a two-way piece to it. It's how to really think through setting up those deadlines in a realistic way that people will get back. But no, there are actually a good chunk of people of color. And I'll send you just the program from last year's New Horizons conference, and it blows your mind to see how many people of color there actually are. So you could get a balance.
Yeah, that would be super helpful. I mean, I wish I had a list.
Oh, we exist.
I mean, one thing that I, you know, we should throw it out to questions pretty soon from the assembled, but one of the things I sort of wanted to ask, and maybe this is more a question for Rhonda or for Dr. Taylor, but what role does the media, environmental media, media at large, have in perpetuating this idea that the environmental movement, environmental organizations are white? Is it the deadlines that we have? Is it the fact and the time that we don't take to like get to more diverse sources? And so are we ending up as a big group of journalists essentially being a predominantly white profession reporting on predominantly white characters and sort of perpetuating this?
Part of the stereotypes that get perpetuated. Sometimes I say, if I have one more journalist email me to talk about white people, black people being afraid to go to the wilderness or to the national park, I'm really going to scream. And I've actually stopped not even answering some of those emails because it's part of how narratives are created. So we create national parks and wilderness and outdoor spaces as white spaces, whether or not we're conscious or subliminally doing it. When we create that, we tend to create urban as people of color, brown, outdoor spaces as whites, and the people who engage those are seen as just so aberrant, in a way. And so the stories are often framed, geez, I want to do a story on how few people of color are in a national park. I just took 25 students of color into Yellowstone, and we rocked it. Plus myself, plus three staff of color. And there isn't a journalist who would find that in the least bit interesting to cover. Yet while we were in that space, so many of those students of color said, oh my God, I didn't A, know this existed, but B, that I could work in this space, contribute to this space, connect what's happening in these spaces with what's happening in my communities. So that kind of transformation is seen as completely boring. I'm from Michigan. Next week at this time, and actually if I wasn't here, I'd have been driving up to my cottage to hang out with the black bears. It's right on Lake Michigan, and I precisely bought it because Nature Conservancy protected 48 acres on one side of me, so I don't have any cracker white neighbor one end of me. And so they don't realize that people like me exist all over the place, and my black children have been through more national parks than just about any white kid I put them up against. And so the complication of people of color communities go missing in a lot of the storytelling. The naturalness around environment. When I give my talks, I often talk about someone like the slave, Phyllis Wheatley, who is the first person. She was a slave brought into a house in Boston, so she was taught to read and write. And by the 1700s, she was starting to write about American Romanticism in a way 100-plus years before Emerson and Thoreau and Muir did. We give them all the credit, but here's a slave writing in this very pro-environmental way more than 100 years before any white men in this country. When I talk about someone like Harriet Tubman in my narratives, I talk about her in a way that shows that if she didn't have, as I say to my students, lose your cell phones and your GPS. If somebody had some dogs chasing you through the woods at night, would you be able to find your way out of slavery if you were running away? And here is a 29-year-old woman who was able to do it not once, but over 300 times. And the reason she could do what she did was because she was so environmentally attuned. She understood the environment very well, and she turned that vessel of captivity on the southern plantation and was able to use that knowledge. She knew where the moss grew on the sides of the tree, knew that the moss is heavier on the north side than the south. All she needed was a GPS north. And so she used ecology as her mechanism. Feel the tree in the dark. Wherever the moss is heavier, head north. If you don't have that, use the North Star. So slaves knew how to read and find the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, to navigate north. These are ways in which we don't think of environment, don't understand how intimately connected people of color had to have been to survive you know, that mass human trafficking moment of slavery. Sacagawea, the child bride, who took Lewis and Clark to the West. I often say she should have left them out there. They took a slave with them, York. I told you, the thought bubble here gets me in trouble. But York, the slave, the two only people who didn't get land and money after the Lewis and Clark 1803 to 1806 expedition was Sacagawea, the child bride, with that baby on her back, and York, the slave. And so it's understanding these pieces of narratives that when we come forward to today, we are not seen as unusual or whatever to do environment, but it's also to tell these stories in more complicated ways than just, oh, you guys are either not in a movement or you went to the park and you freaked out. No. All of us freak out in the park, you know. I have 2 10-year-old daughters who got their open water scuba diving certification because they want to do marine biology. Mm-hmm. And they're not unusual at all. Not that we should forget the kids that's not their life and they're living in different circumstances, but we can't just stereotype. You know, there are more right now. They just had a conference, PGM1, People of the Global Majority, Outdoor, Nature, and Environment. They had hundreds of people trying to get into the arena in Oakland for that conference. And out of that conference, there's Black Girls Climb, Outdoor Afro, Latina Outdoors, you know, just tons of these groups. You know, all Black People of Color expedition teams, scaling Mount McKinley and wanting to Everest, scuba doing everything. Black ski weekend, Latina ski weekend. So for us to sit here and say, oh, you know, there's very few of it, or we can't find them, we're just not in the network, we're not connected.
Right.
But it exists.
I wanted to say that the media that approaches me is slim. Mm-hmm. Most media in the Detroit area are more interested in killings and mm-hmm. carjacks, rape, and things like that. It becomes a challenge to get the media to come out and cover an environmental issue. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, David Spratt from he was the first one to approach us and even bring together some journalists that we met with so that we can start talking to them and encourage them to cover environmental issues. And so your organization is just totally new. I did not know that you existed. I'm glad that you do. I would just say, you know, come on and cover more. Just because it's a challenge. Mm-hmm. Then I would also say, too, about the media. The media, pretty much like what Dr. Taylor is describing, wants to portray us in all these other ways and not as someone that's really interested in the environment. From the studies that I've seen, when it comes to voting environmental issues, Black folks and Latinos vote environment way more than white folks do.
And our Congress people are the most pro-environmental voting bloc in the House and in the Senate since the 90s. Mm-hmm. So it's not just us on the ground voting, it's the people we elect who go in and vote, but it's the people still call my white colleagues as opposed to calling me and they want to talk about environment and diversity. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, well, if you talk to every white colleague in my building before you even get to me, keep talking to them and see how much data you get. They don't have a sense of the issue. They don't understand the issues very well. So sometimes it's also just what people are attuned to and what they do.
And then, sorry, but Zoe's work?
Yeah, the Newsweek cover story from a couple years ago.
Zoe, that coverage was instrumental in closing down 3 coal power plants. That moved a major corporation within the state of Michigan to make the announcement that we had been trying to convince them to do in the first place. Just tell. We knew that they were going to close the plants. We just wanted them to make an announcement so that people can go and start making that transition from this tax base, mm-hmm. which was 30% of the budget for the city of River Rouge, mm-hmm. and trying to come up with another kind of another livelihood, another way to for that city to exist. Mm-hmm. So when she covered that story, that was huge. That was instrumental. And then can we also say that once that plant is closed, because now we don't even know with Trump doing his thing about coal now, and now they're talking about continuing to operate the plant, even mm-hmm. though they've told us that they're going to close it down. You know, we now know that once that coal power plant is closed, health is going to improve immediately, mm-hmm. because the environment is going to improve immediately. Mm-hmm. SO2 is the main contributor to asthma, mm-hmm. especially in children. It will immediately get better. So these are some of the things that can happen when you cover these stories.
Okay, so with that, I want to thank our panelists, and I want to throw it out to question and answer. So first priority is to SEJ members and journalists. If you want to ask a question, please identify yourself and the organization you're with. So just so everybody heard that she's asking, are there dependable media outlets who want to cover environmental justice? I'm just going to go ahead and say Grist, but if anybody else wants to.
Yeah, Grist has been good for both diversity. When Breton was there, mm-hmm. I think Breton did about 15 articles right after the Green 2.0 report came out. It just elevated it. You did. So, but when environmental justice, one of the challenges is not just is it the publication or the news outlet as opposed to an individual reporter. Mm-hmm. So when the reporter moves on, oftentimes the interest in the publication wanes. So if you look at environmental justice in the early 1990s, the main outlets were coming out of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and there were people of color journalists in those outlets that were really kind of feeding those stories. San Francisco Chronicle also did some really early good reporting. Over time, it's become so kind of reporter-dependent as opposed to a news outlet saying we should continually follow up and have these pieces. I find with the diversity pieces, again, I was getting more coverage from The Guardian, Le Monde. So these are foreign outlets that mm-hmm. are picking up and reporting on these diversity reports more so than, say, the Detroit Free Press or even the New York Times. They came on much later. One important source that I've been seeing a lot is like the different NPR stations and radio stations. So I've gotten, you know, like really interesting interviews from the strangest of radio shows, and often they're useful because they give you like a half an hour, and they do the story format, they do the data piece, and especially if there's a local twist to it, they do it. So radio still becomes an interesting piece, and the blogging, but I find it really still very hard to get these stories out, especially if they're uplifting, positive, non-stereotypical stories of people of color. Mm-hmm. There's virtually no interest.
I will say, I think the market is changing, though. I mean, my publication, Earther, which is a part of Gizmodo, we just launched a year ago. We have a year now, and they hired me with the intention of my covering environmental justice. Yeah. Justine is one of the hires for Gris and environmental justice, although you guys are already on this environmental justice beat for a while. Huffington Post just hired an environmental justice journalist. Mother Jones has an environmental justice journalist. There's like, the positions are appearing now where national publications are hopping on the bandwagon of we want a reporter strictly on environmental justice. And I think that it's in part due to major media events that have happened, like the Flint water crisis that kind of opened the country's eyes to environmental justice and what it actually is, or Standing Rock in North Dakota, which again opened people's eyes to what is another instance of environmental injustice. So I think that the interest is growing. Publications are realizing that there is a market for it. But it's also, you know, it's a tough sell. I know that from writing these stories every day that readers don't always have the most interest in environmental justice stories. And I'm not sure how that might impact that down the line if publications realize that they don't get, you know, it's not as clickbaity as a story on, like, satellite images of a hurricane or something.
Right.
Which just blow up and do so well.
But it is, I mean, Dr. Taylor's point is well taken. It does, in many instances, it is reporter-driven at this stage, though the hope is that's changing. And, you know, it's like I said when we started, we were talking about how environmental organizations have a diversity problem. Well, you know, journalism does too. And, you know, one of the things that we are very focused on at Grist is writing stories that reflect the audience we want to have. And so that means writing stories about different, varying communities. It means writing positive stories wherever possible. And that's sort of how that starts. And it's a cultural thing. It's the same thing as, like, putting together a diversity plan to change the complexion and the makeup of your organization. You know, you sort of have to put that into place for your content as well, so that the two are sort of working hand in hand. So, you know, it comes from... It's something that has to be a cultural shift.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to touch on another news story that broke, and it was a TV channel that came out to a home where the resident in that home had taken a bucket, an air bucket, mm-hmm. that from a global community monitoring. He would send these buckets out to community, and they could use the bucket to capture air samples. Mm-hmm. So instead of her taking her air sample outside, she took it inside of her house because there was this noxious odor in her home. She took it inside and she took the sample, sent it off, and the lab was so alarmed at what they saw as a result, they contacted us and said, this woman has to get out of her house. Well, when we turned that report in to the state of Michigan, to MDEQ, MDEQ did nothing. They did not say, oh, we should follow up on this. They did not say, let's inform that community that something is going on wrong. There was absolute silence. And it was only after a TV reporter somehow came up on this, went into this woman's home, went into her basement, and the reporter herself said, look, I can't, she, on the film, said she couldn't stay in that house, got out. Then that struck EPA. The EPA came out and did a sample with the same results, which was something like 21 toxic gases were coming up through this woman's basement. And then we asked them to go over to another residence home. They took samples there and came out with the same thing, which resulted in Marathon Oil Refinery purchasing 30-some homes in that area and then purchasing something like 530 homes in another area. So when you cover these stories, it makes a difference, a major, major difference. You can literally save lives.
Any other questions? And the question was, how do you make EJ stories more clickable generally?
So first off, it's an equation that I still have yet to solve. But my editor and I play around with a few different things that we hope can bring people into it. First of all, I think that, like, positive solutions-based stories, I think, tend to be more appealing for people. And they also are much more fun to work on and I think, enlightening to work on. But part of what we at least have tried to play around with is doing, playing around with headlines. It's just like trying to figure out what is the right equation for this headline so that we can bring as many people in and just, like, you know, get them with that lead and then keep them there, which we haven't quite figured out what kind of headline gets people in. but right now our tactic is to try to make a general headline that it can either be a little sassy, a little spicy, but that maybe appeals to a broader public. Maybe if my story is about discrimination or racism, maybe we won't call that out in the headline right away, because unfortunately I think people can get turned off by that. But it's not a formula that I feel confident to tell other people to use, because it still hasn't proven to work too well for us. But my philosophy is, if you do a really, really important and, you know, well-written, well-reported story, my features do much better than, say, the quick stories I do in a day that get at policy or something. And those stories, you know, have the narrative, they have the characters, they have the photography, they have the time to make it hard to ignore. And I think that that's, you know, one of the few things that any reporter can do to make sure people are interested in. I don't know, maybe Nikhil has some suggestions. You're an editor, you might know more.
headline is obviously, you know, the sort of, that display copy is going to be what brings people in. And one of the things that we're sort of trying to do at Grist is be willing to change headlines.
Yeah, we do that. We change headlines.
It doesn't happen with every story, but we've also found, and we are in part a solutions, you know, driven publication, and so we are actually looking for those sorts of stories purposefully, and that's been somewhat helpful. But, you know, I think that the market for these sorts of stories is actually growing, and by telling more and more of them, you grow that market. And you bring new. The thing that's interesting about EJ stories for us is that they're first-time visitors often to Grist. And so they're the stories, like, it's Justine's job. She's like our ambassador of the Grist brand because she writes most of our justice work. And that means that our job is to take Justine's sort of piece and get people into other parts of the site, get them familiar with Grist. And it's really, at the end of the day, kind of a way of hopefully expanding our audience. You know, it's something we're still working on, but, you know, it's the Wild West out on the internet, and when there's a Supreme Court vacancy, it's hard to get any story through.
That's true.
Are you guys missing a big piece of the market, and that's the kind of millennial crowd? Because it used to be, for instance, when I was teaching, I wouldn't have the students use as much, like, newspaper articles, where they had to balance it out. But now in the classroom, and I know I'm not alone, a lot of professors are doing it where, for instance, every discussion section, I want the students to bring in, like, a newspaper, journal, blog piece that's really related to the story. They can compare and contrast in the classroom. And so these shorter pieces that are written by non-academics have become a more standard piece of the teaching portfolio and the way students are getting their information. And so so that's definitely something to think about. You know, literally just about every topic I've done this semester already, we have at least one discussion where the students go out and find, you know, the latest articles on X, bring it in to kind of have it as a counterbalance to the more traditional articles that are being read. So for justice pieces, there's a huge audience around the world, not just the U.S., around the world, on these kinds of stories being used by students in the classroom and being brought in. So I don't know how that relates to click rates or how it gets pulled in. But there are many ways that people are accessing these, and we probably have to get to a better way of figuring out traffic. I know I have my students, for instance, put their really good term papers on ResearchGate, and they're shocked that, like, overnight they can get 2,000 reads. You know, that diversity transparency report that I put straight on there, I had, I think, around 10,000 reads in less than 2 weeks off of it.
Wow.
So there definitely is a market out there and accessing and, you know, that to me, I'm seeing an uptick in it and the way it's coming into the classroom, the way it's being used. It also goes way down the chain because I'm getting more and more high school and junior high school kids going, I'm doing a project or a paper on environmental justice, and I read your toxic communities, or we had a chapter to read, and I want to interview. So, yeah, these little middle schoolers are beating you all out to the interviews because they're coming straight to us. I mean, literally about the past 2 or 3 years. A ton of them where they're being assigned to go interview the author, the writer, the reporter, and they're doing their own reporting. So that's your competition, people. And so your work, you might not think only of what's my audience at Grist, but what's my audience in the grammar school and the kindergarten and the middle and high school, and how you might want to think about putting your articles on different kinds of platforms, because they're into the texting, the phoning. And in my typical class, if we're doing something, I say, okay, anybody check on your phones and find this out. And they're looking for that kind of stuff. So that might be one way you might want to think about how do you platform your pieces, and to not just the 35 or 50-something-year-old, but that 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old kid, that they're doing this kind of research in just about every grammar school, it seems like, in the country. And the market for that audience is not very big in terms of articles that those younger kids can read, digest, and use.
There's time for one more question if anybody has one. Otherwise, we will adjourn. All right. I want to thank Yesenia, Dr. Taylor, and Rhonda for taking some time out.